Okay, Rob, how are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Yeah, Rob, we really appreciate you agreeing to come on our podcast. I'm very excited to have you. And for the listeners that don't know Rob, Rob presented a fantastic presentation at our GSF conference this year. So we're very lucky to have him on online.
No problem. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be able to do it.
Yeah, great. So, Rob, for the listeners and the people that don't know you, if you could tell us a little bit about your background, your current role, and how you got into it, that would be great.
So my background is probably a little bit long-winded. I mean, like many S&C coaches, was a bit of a failed athlete. So, bizarrely, growing up in Australia, my big passion was football, not AFL, but the European kind. So I was big into that and wanted to be a professional player. Soon realized that wasn't going to happen after I relocated to the UK and was studying here. And I first really came across strength and conditioning through working as a personal trainer, and a good colleague of mine, a guy called Matt Church, was getting involved with strength and conditioning with Surrey County Cricket. And I kind of said to him, look, can I come and shadow a few sessions and see what this is all about? Because I'd never even heard the term before, didn't know it was a thing. So I went and watched him and thought, this is really what I want to do. I don't want to be working with the general public anymore. I want to be working in sport and in athletics, or with athletic development. So I started down that and had kind of found a university course at St. Mary's in strength and conditioning science. So I went and studied that, and it was everything I'd hoped it would be. Obviously you have ups and downs in university, but I loved every second of it. Loved the lectures, loved the practicals, loved everything involved in that. And alongside that, I started doing work experience. So I collected some work experience at Harlequins Rugby League, alongside doing the women's rugby union team at the university. And then went on to do a part-time kind of work experience at Watford Football Club alongside doing the men's rugby league team, and then kind of grew out of there and just collecting experience everywhere you could. Went on to do a master's in physiology and then landed my first strength and conditioning role down at the Leaf Studio School down in Bournemouth, which was a newly formed sport academy. So it was then exposed to numerous different sports I'd never come across, like beach volleyball, golf, swimming, in particular, those kind of things. I had over 100 athletes that myself and Tom Smale were involved in the physical development of. So it was a fantastic kind of first grounding in strength and conditioning. And since then, I've gone on to be involved in a number of different places. I was at Wolverhampton Wanderers for a very short period of time, had a brief spell in kind of private health. And then once my girlfriend got a PhD in Edinburgh, I decided to throw a caution to the wind and moved up here. And eventually settled in at Scottish Rugby after being a contractor for a period of time. So I'm now an assistant strength and conditioning coach in the Borders and East Lothian Academy, which sits under Scottish Rugby. So it's one of four regional academies that's kind of tasked with developing the next generation of professional players.
Wow, quite a background, and what an amazing story. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's pretty very lot of movements. Like I actually, the other day for a presentation, threw together a map of all my movements across the UK and my coaching, and it's a bit of a road trip.
Yeah, but you know, brilliant development, and I imagine you've gained a lot of wisdom through it as well. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's really pretty great.
So obviously the podcast that we're going to aim this today at talking about youth athlete development, which I know you're pretty passionate about, and you've set up an online community around that. So you could give a little bit of information to listeners about the organization as well.
Yeah, so basically a long time ago, about 2 years ago, I set up a seminar with Dan Baker, and there happened to be a few strength and conditioning coaches there who were involved in coaching youth populations. And we kind of got together and said, you know what, we should meet up occasionally, or we should have a chat, because, you know, it's pretty unusual that, you know, to have full-time guys in youth S&C. And we kind of decided the best way to do that was to do it via Facebook. So we started a really small Facebook group, and over the last 2.5 years or something, that's now grown to have 1,500 people in it,
wow,
including the likes of Clive Brewer at the Toronto Blue Jays, Des Ryan at Arsenal, Dan Baker himself. So it's a real fantastic community where anyone, you know, is welcome, involved in terms of youth athletic development, whether they're just a mum and dad coach, you know, working with under-10s, right up to professional academy coaches. So it's a fantastic environment to share knowledge, to ask questions, to get questions answered. Just myself the other day had a new GPS system that I wasn't used to, and I knew guys on the group had, and so within 10 minutes I had a question answered that I'd been struggling with for 30 minutes because someone there knew the answer and could straight away give it to us. So it's a really beneficial environment if you're involved in athletic development. So you can just search youth trainers and coaches and you can find that on Facebook.
Yeah, and we can totally vouch for that, myself and all of our coaching staff are on there, and that it's absolutely right. It's a wealth of information, and what a supportive community, particularly focusing around youth athlete development. It's really cool. You've also got Athletic Evolution as well. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so Athletic Evolution is a funny one. It's my own little baby, if you like. I probably established that during a period of frustration when I was working in private health and I wasn't involved in sport, and I decided that I wanted to keep my fingers in the pie of sport. So I started kind of blogging about the different kind of thought process that I had and reflections on working in sport, with no real particular audience in mind, just thinking I'll just, you know, put my thoughts down, and if anyone happens to read it, then that's a bonus. And gradually over time, that it's grown. It's got a bit of a following. I think I've had over like 35,000 views now. It's been going for 2 years, but it's evolved into a business that is focused on spreading best practice in the development of youth athletes. So number of articles on, you know, long-term athlete development around you know, different workshops and ideas and different books and et cetera, and interviews with different practitioners. But essentially now it's a vehicle for spreading best practice. So whether that is via, you know, written kind of articles or via workshops and conferences like the one you ran, John. And, you know, more and more, I'm seeing more and more requests for this kind of service. So just this week, I'm delivering a nutrition workshop for a group here in Edinburgh. I've got another one booked in November. I've just got off the phone from another islander to discuss heading out there to run a seminar workshop there. So yeah, it's really become a vehicle to get the message out there in terms of what is best practice with youth athletic development.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And I must say that's actually how I first heard about you as well, through the Athletic Evolution page, because out there at the moment, it's really a difficult sort of jungle understanding S&C for athletic populations. And it's such a new field, really, as well, the applied side of youth athlete development. So it was really great to have a resource that, you know, you can go to, which is looking at some of the busting of the myths, the current position papers around best practice, and just some general guidelines. And I think it's a really cool idea. So I really appreciate you doing that. So with that in mind, I'd love to hear a little bit about what you're most passionate about with youth athlete development and the areas that you think are most crucial to long-term development athletes. So if you could sort of take us along a little journey as to kind of which areas you most enjoy working in and which areas you think are the most crucial for the development of the long-term development of athletes, sort of including the whole sort of global view of the way we develop an athlete as opposed to just looking at the S&C side, how it all links together. That would be cool.
Yeah, I think if you'd asked me this question straight out of university, I would have said 100% maximum strength and power would have been the areas I'm most passionate about, because that's the sexy stuff. That's when you can get the gym aware out, the force plates out, and you know, people are, you know, crushing big weights, and it's really impressive. I think as I have moved on and matured in my coaching journey, I would now really say, in terms of the youth populations, now the thing I'm most passionate about is movement and about technique. Because what I encounter regularly is people who have come in working with someone who is really trying to crush that max strength and power element, but it was at the cost of the movement and technique base. So I see, you know, kind of very headstrong male rugby players who come in and tell me they can squat and bench X amount, but when you see it in action, you're kind of hoping they're not going to fall apart. So you then have to take, you know, the hit on the ego and pull them back and try and refine those motor skills. So for me, that is the foundation of athletic development, is having really good, solid, robust, and optimal kind of movement patterns before you load up on those things. Because ultimately, you can have poor technique or poor movement, and you can probably get strong, but you won't be strong for very long, because ultimately you're going to break. And that's the message I try and get across to my guys, is that, yeah, okay, you might get to benching 120 like that, but how long are you going to be doing it for? You know, you might be doing it for another week, you might be doing it for another month, maybe another year, but at some point, it's going to come back to bite you in the backside, because your movement is poor. And at that point in time, you're going to have to relearn how to move properly. So you can either take the hit now and relearn it and improve your technique, or you can take the hit when you're injured. But the choice is yours. You can't bypass that phase. You're going to have to learn how to move well if you want to perform at a high level.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Dan Pfaff famously said, quoted once, movement drives the bus, I think, from what I've recently seen on a resource, which I thought was quite quite wise. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the movement aspect to it has traditionally been a bit forgotten about within the S&C, and it's kind of got a bit of a bad rep. I think from an injury prevention, but also from an efficiency perspective, you know, we obviously first rule for us is do no harm, and obviously ensure that the athlete has an injury prevention component to the training, a large injury prevention component.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the best way to injure someone is poor biomechanics plus a load, whether that is, you know, a weight or a speed. And I mean, in my mind now as well, you know, the most efficient way to get strong is to have good technique. You know, if the fastest way from A to B is a short, you know, a short line, a straight line, and you're taking a curved approach, you're being inefficient. And I think actually the best way to learn or to get strong in a bench press is to have the best technique. The best way to get strong in a squat is to have the best technique, because you'll automatically be able to lift better and more because you're in better positions and optimal, you know, force production. If you're outside of that, you're inefficient, you're costing yourself energy, and you're going to line yourself up for injury ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. Cool. So I think it's probably worth us having a look at some of the elephants in the room around S&C. Typically we hear the thing from parents about, oh, my children shouldn't lift weights, it's going to stunt their growth, or it's going to cause an injury. And I think we probably need to set the record straight on some of this. So what are the typical misconceptions that you hear, and how would you go back to iron some of those out?
Yeah, I think a classic one is, lifting weights stunts your growth, which I can't remember who it was, but someone once said, well, then does playing basketball make you tall? you know, there's this this correlation is not causation, that actually a lot of these weightlifters are small because it's actually efficient biomechanically to be small. But the literature just doesn't support that. There's been maybe one or two very poorly kind of translated or poorly communicated studies where, you know, youths who were unsupervised and basically let loose in a gym got injured. Like, surprise, surprise. You know, if you let a number of young boys loose in any area, someone's going to come back hurt, whether you've got a barbell or not. So I think a lot of it is common sense in terms of, yes, you need to supervise young athletes. That's a given. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. And I think it's also just, you know, applying one very small context to a much larger context. So, yes, there's been an injury in an unsupervised situation, and it's to a local growth plate. Is that going to stop them being 6'4" if they've injured a growth plate in their wrist? Probably not. And actually, the literature doesn't support it in terms of, you know, growth and maturation. Actually, during periods of adolescence is actually the optimal time to load bone, because we want, you know, strong, solid bones with good bone mineral content. The best way to do that is to load it. You know, if you look at the extreme end, in terms of astronauts going to space, because of the lack of gravity in space, they come back with very fragile skeletons. So we actually, our skeleton requires loading for adaptation. It requires, you know, gravity, whether it's jumping, whether it's, you know, external load in a form of a barbell or a medicine ball, whatever, we require loading for our skeleton to adapt and become more solid. So actually, there's no better time than adolescence to be, you know, cashing in on the enhanced protection, if you like, of having a good bone mineral content. So, you know, the myth of youth athletes, you know, not needing to lift weight, or, you know, the fact that lifting weights can stunt your growth is just simply not supported. And, you know, there's now a number of papers out there from the NSCA, from the UKSCA, from BASES, from the ASCA to, you know, and even the American College of Orthopedics, pediatricians, is basically saying, actually, this isn't the case, and that actually we require, you know, stimulus for adaptation of the skeleton. So that's the biggest elephant in the room, I would say. The other big one is, you know, certain exercises being demonized. So the classic one is squatting being bad for knees, lifting being bad for back. For me, it's like any skill. Any skill that's done, as you know, as we've already mentioned, with poor technique or poor movement is a risk factor for injury, and squatting and deadlifting is no different. Yeah, I'm in the gym all the time, and you watch the general public do movements, and I can see why the deadlift has a bad reputation, because I can see, you know, guys in their 20s deadlifting with possibly the worst technique possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's only, you know, you only need to put the stopwatch on for how long it's actually going to take before someone starts saying, my back hurts. And it's like, well, maybe your back hurts not because of the deadlift, but because of the way you're moving. So that's a classic one is, you know, and the research, again, doesn't support it, you know, in terms of the squats being bad for your knees. If you look at some of the research out there in terms of the loading of your knee at different angles, you know, it's actually, by going through a full range of motion squat, you're actually promoting the kind of influx of new nutrients in terms of the fluid within the knees, et cetera. And, range of motion. So actually, the literature just doesn't support it. It's usually uninformed opinion or kind of urban myth that where these things come out of. So yeah, it's essentially, you know, I don't think it's malicious. I think people have a good motivation for wanting to protect youth athletes, but essentially it's put in the wrong place. And yeah. One of the best ways to avoid injury is to be strong, because it means you're simply harder to injure. You're more robust. But the way we go about doing that is important, and the fact that we do it with optimal technique is important. So yeah, they would be the two big ones that I would say. Another big one is that lifting makes you slow, and I think there's a little bit of validity to that if you lift slowly. You know, if your aim is to be fast, you need to practice being fast. So you know, it's probably not great to be grinding out really slow squats if you're trying to be a really fast sprinter. You probably need to work on being quick. So yeah, you want to work on your force production, but you also need to be aware that if, you know, all your training is done really slowly, then that's not what you're actually trying to achieve, is it, in the long term? So yeah, being aware of lifting speeds and power output and what you're trying to achieve in the long term is an important factor.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's great. And I think one of the issues that we're seeing more and more, as children are getting less and less exposed to load in their free play time. Probably thinking back to when we were young, we were jumping out tree houses, absorbing huge amounts of force, landing on the floor, and getting our ligaments and tendons adapted, the nervous systems adapted to absorbing force. Well, the kids just aren't getting that anymore. And I think 100%. Structured youth S&C sessions now have an even more vital role than they ever did, simply because of laying the appropriate foundations for athletic competency that probably wasn't necessarily needed so much, you know, 20, 30 years ago, which is so essential now. So
yeah, 100%. And, you know, we only need to look at what's happening in terms of schools having their PE trimmed away and trimmed away and trimmed away. And again, that's kind of poor practice because it's not, you know, whichever way you look at it, it's not supported by the evidence. You know, the evidence that actually being physically active improves your capacity to learn, but that's just from a mental standpoint. What about your physical? You know, we look at the elements of, you know, rising obesity, poor activity levels, things like type 2 diabetes on the rise, and often it comes back to just kids these days are not moving enough.
Yeah,
and they're not prepared for the demands of life, never mind performance sport.
Yeah, there's not moving enough, not moving well enough, and with enough intensity for sure. We get what, in inverted commas, performance athletes or high performance athletes coming in and they can't do 10 push-ups, which, you know, is becoming the norm. And then it seems to like that's a difficult challenge. But, you know, 30, 40 years ago, that was just, you wouldn't, 10 push-ups was an absolute basic level. But now it seems to be kind of an advanced level, which is this sort of easy level has become the norm and it's sort of become difficult, which is just scary. And then even you look at the mechanics of how they do the push-up and the integrity posturally and the scapular thoracic movement is just, it's frightening in some cases. And then when you look at how many of these kids can do a pull-up, which is an essential part of play, more often than not, we're seeing children now can't even do one pull-up. So yeah, it's from our perspective, it's definitely quite a frightening area. So, you know, there's a real place for youth athletic development programs because it adds the base bedrock, right, of everything we do, and whether they're going to be fit, healthy individuals involved in participatory sport for the rest of their lives, which is great from a health outcome, or whether it's involved in being a performing athlete or a high-performance athlete, that sort of all comes from the same place, which is athletic literacy bedrock. So it's absolutely essential.
Yeah, I'm part of NSCA Long-Term Athletic Development Group on Facebook as well, and I saw yesterday someone posted, there's a link to a documentary, I think, that's been produced, but it's called The Motivation Factor, and it's about PE in American schools 50 years ago. And honestly, when you see the absolute specimen that these guys have produced in PE, like, it's unbelievable. And when you, if you were to compare them to PE today, like, it's high school level PE, so it's not the primary, but these guys look like Olympic gymnasts. They're absolutely shredded, they're muscular, they're athletic. And what we've basically done over the last 50 years is just watered this down and watered it down, and we've turned into, you know, have you seen Wall-E and those, the Disney film? Yeah. Everyone's in those hover chairs, and one of them falls out, they can't even get up. That's where we're headed.
Yeah.
You know, children who are playing consoles 24 hours a day and not getting enough sleep and eating horrific diets, and, you know, we're not setting our kids up for success.
Absolutely. And just for listeners out there, we'll make some of those resources available that Rob's mentioned with regards to the UKCA position statements and some of the NSCA position statements on youth athletic development and strength training for the viewers and the listeners to have a look at. Also probably add in there some of Avery Fagenbaum's stuff is really
good.
Fantastic.
Yeah. In fact, I think he's one of the primary authors on most of those papers, to be honest, because he's been the go-to guy for so long.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other key issues that we get, Rob, around S&C and athlete development is really how it fits and aligns in with the technical sport preparation. And so sometimes as S&C coaches, we have to put our hands up and we can be guilty of working in silos and isolating the technical coach. How do we ensure there's a seamless, join up between what the technical coach is doing, what the S&C practitioners are doing, and how do we really get that buy-in from coaches?
I think part of this comes from a bit of an ego check on the S&C front. If you'd asked me this question again, 8-9 years ago, I wouldn't have given you this answer. But now, having worked in sport for a long period of time, I think we need to kind of be aware of where we sit in the hierarchy, and that the most important factor in becoming an elite level sports performer is time on task in terms of technical practice. So it doesn't matter how great how big your bench is, how good your squat is, how much you can power clean or jump or your yo-yo, if you can't catch a rugby ball, you are not going to play Premiership rugby. So ultimately, you need to be able to do that. There's that primary skill set that's involved with the sport. So the most important factor in becoming a high-level sport performer is time on task. And I went to a workshop recently with Nick Chad from Man City, down in Leeds. He was talking about this, and he was basically discussing the same thing. But he's saying, what is the biggest influence on being able to give that sports performer as much time on task as possible? And it's availability. For me, and I say this to my athletes a lot, the best ability is availability. So your availability to train, your availability to compete, because that is what's going to develop you as an athlete. Now, if you're injured, you're unavailable. So you're unavailable to train, you're unavailable to compete, you're not developing as a sports performer if you're injured. So what's one of the best ways we can improve your ability to improve as a sports performer? Well, it's to keep you injury free. How do we do that? Well, we get you strong, we get you robust, we get you fit. So it comes back to the physical element, but it's understanding that the physical element underpins everything else in terms of, in order for you to be able to train and play, you've got to be healthy, you've got to be fit. Mm. To do that, there's some underlying things that are going to help, which are being strong, being powerful, being fit, being robust, doing your prehab, doing your mobility. So it comes back to the physical element, but it's understanding that's in the background. Everyone looks at the skill and looks at how much people are spending on the skill element, but the underpinning of that is the physical capacity to do those skills. So the best way to maximize skill development is time on task. The best way to maximize time on task is not to be injured. The best way to not be injured is S&C.
I totally agree with that, and I think there's a fair bit of education that needs to be done still at the grassroots and the youth development levels to really help all involved in the athlete's holistic development to sort of understand that. And I think one of the difficulties with an S&C is you have, as you've rightly mentioned, your graduates and post-graduate level coaches working in S&C, which really alienates the technical coach because you end up not having the same educational pathway not necessarily the same education pathway for the coaches, and what ends up happening is you have almost a very unexperienced but overly educated graduate working S&C, and then you tend to have a very, very experienced coach who's taken a lot of athletes to high level, very, very wise, who doesn't necessarily have the scientific background that the graduate has. And I think there has to be something done there to try and ensure that those two work better together and inform each other to help it work a little bit more seamlessly.
Yeah, I think, you've got to be aware of your position in the hierarchy. As much as it's not, a territorial thing or an ego thing, the skills coach wins. And the skills coach will always win. So whether that is the amount of time he gives you for your warm-up or the amount of time he gives you for the athletes in the gym, he or she drives the ship, essentially. And the buck stops with them, and the higher you get into performance sport, the more pressure there is on the head coach. So they're driving the bus, essentially, and they will give you as much time as they think is appropriate. Now, it's up to you to, over time, create the relationship with that coach where they trust you enough that you're not going to do anything stupid, that you're going to improve people, that you're going to develop them. So you need to be aware that the skills coach is going to win, and you need to be smart at picking your battles. And I would really recommend people read Brett Bartholomew's book, Conscious Coaching, about building buy-in. It's a real fantastic blend of, research-based practice alongside analogy and anecdotes of coaches in the field, predominantly with athletes, but it's true of staff as well. You know, if you can get the best tool or asset you can have is a good working relationship with the head coach.
Yeah.
You know, that is going to buy you leeway in the gray areas. It's going to buy you extra time on task when you need it. You know, you need to be flexible, but you need to understand the skills coach wins. So your biggest asset is to have a good working relationship with them.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Rob, that's really great. Just moving on now slightly to looking at some of the key considerations when working with youth athletes. Obviously, we all know they're different from adults. And there's been some sort of key elements, and you raised them in the conference quite nicely, looking at things like biobanding, peak height velocity monitoring, so on and so forth. Could you just talk for the listeners, just so we can go through, just to understand some of those key markers and some of those things that you would look at with your youth athletes that might be slightly different from the things you look at when monitoring your adult athletes?
Yeah, I think it is a different scenario, and we need to understand that youth athletes aren't miniature adults, so we can't just cut and paste adult training templates onto kids. We need to understand they're going through a very dynamic and non-linear process that is growth and maturation. So, you take any group of 20 kids between the ages of 12 and 15, you'll have any different, stages of maturation looking at them. I mean, I've trained 14-year-old youth athletes that had a beard, and versus kids who look like they're fresh out the womb. So you've got, two extreme ends of the spectrum, and they're going to respond to training very differently based on their hormonal profiles. One will put on muscle mass a lot easier than the other. So you're essentially, if you're delivering a program aimed at putting on muscle mass to the one who hasn't got that hormonal profile, it's not going to work. So we need to be aware of how things are changing. So a big one is, peak height velocity. So the idea of around, 13 to 14, generally speaking, in males, and 11 to 12 in females, that we're going to get that change in height that's going to be quite rapid. And that's, you don't need to be a genius to figure out that's going to affect your coordination, which is going to affect, motor control, et cetera. So being aware of that is a big factor, and being sensitive to that you need to account for leeway potentially in your program and understand that skill development isn't going to be as simple as A, B, C, D, E. That there might be, a two forward, one back kind of scenario in terms of, people growing and adapting to new kind of limb lever lengths and motor pathways, et cetera. So I think a real big emphasis needs to be on motor control. So this is where, a number of methods like manipulating the tempo, manipulating the balance element, your variations that you're choosing, whether it's a goblet squat, overhead squat, back squat, et cetera. You can be smart in deloading an athlete around that period of time when they're increasing in height really rapidly, but still training those movement patterns. So for example, if someone's really shot up in height, it might not be appropriate for them to train back squat, but it might be appropriate for them to do an overhead squat to get a better understanding of coordination and balance and how my lever lengths are relating to each other. So I think that's a real big element. Another key consideration would be, the relative age effect. In the UK, we've been a bit slow to the mark on this. I mean, if you look at the research out of Canada in the 1980s, they found this and they adapted their rules and they got some benefits from that in terms of changing the physicality of the game, which kept more people in the game. I think we've been a bit slow to the party on that front in terms of understanding that if we set a selection year with youth athletes, that the people at the beginning of the selection year are going to have some sort of advantage, generally speaking, over the people at the back. So you get this kind of slant where you get an overrepresentation of people at the front of the selection year versus the back. And it doesn't really matter how you change that selection year. It's still going to happen. So in the Southern Hemisphere, you might do it by academic year, so January to December. In the Northern Hemisphere, it might be academic year here, which is September to August. But you still get that overrepresentation at the front end of the selection year. So being aware of that and being mindful of that, because essentially, at the age of 10, if I'm 12 months older than you, that's a big advantage.
Yeah.
Percentage of our lifespan. My decision making might be better. My experience might be better. If I'm an early maturer as well, I could be, up to 2 or 3 years older than you if you're a late maturer, biologically speaking. So if you look at some of the information that James Baker's put out from Aspire, where he's had the ability to, do X-rays on his athletes and get skeletal ages for them, they've had a vast array of biological ages in a fairly homogenous age group. So, kids up to 18 years old who are actually 13 chronologically, but kids who are 15, 16, but are actually 14 biologically. So you can have a big spectrum. So it's understanding the athletes in front of you is the primary thing for me, looking at them. And you don't need to be a genius. You know, you can see if one's sprouting facial hair and the other one's, you know, still a bag of bones and hasn't grown, that actually there's some variation there and you probably need to adapt what you're doing to reflect that. And if you see people, you know, experiencing difficult periods of coordination, then scaling things back, maybe giving them more time on task, giving them more opportunity to practice, etc. So a lot of it is common sense, but the more informed you are, the more obvious it becomes, which I think is a big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And are there any sort of quick and easy methods for coaches to monitor that other than just sort of the subjective recognition visually? Are there any tools that you use sort of graphically or that objectively that you're able to monitor with?
Yeah, so a real simple one would just be tracking height. So,
yeah,
you know, if you were to track height once a month, you would see, you know, if little Johnny shot up 3 centimeters this month, then he's probably in a period of growth.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from some of the research that potentially they're predisposed to injury around that period of time. You know, if there's growth plates that are kind of a bit fragile, or they're still, you know, very malleable in terms of the bone tissue, then they're open to things like Osgood Schlatter's disease or Sever's disease if their training volumes are really high. So we need to potentially pull back on that. So a really simple one is height. You know, if you're a bit more in depth and you want to learn a bit more, then there's a method out there, the Camus-Roche calculation, where basically you can take date of birth, age, height, weight. If you take mum and dad's height as well, you can get essentially what they call mid-parental height. And this calculation will figure out the projected height for this particular athlete and what current percentage they're at. And within that, there's kind of bandwidth for what would be considered prepubescent or pre-adolescent, sorry, circa adolescent and kind of, you know, late adolescent. So, you know, thresholds of 85 to 90% of your adult height, for example, might put you in one bracket, whereas 95% or above of your predicted height would put you in late adolescence. So, you know, essentially, if you did that for your, you know, youth rugby squad, you know, if you had that data forthcoming from mum and dad, you could essentially get a bit of a profile of, you know, the maturation profile of your squad. And it's not a particularly hard thing to do, you know, outside of collecting height and weight, date of birth is very easy. Getting mum and dad to report their height is pretty easy. And there's calculators online that are pretty accessible to be able to do those calculations and figure out, you know, it will automatically generate the numbers for you. So, and you know, little Johnny is at 93% of his adult height. You know, big Michael's at 99%, so he's probably done growing. So you've got a good kind of, you know, picture of where your kids are at.
Yeah, there's a really nice Science and Sport, which is for the listeners, an online sports science resource provider, an Excel template, which does exactly that, which we've used to pretty good effect in our program. So I'll link that into the bottom of the podcast page as well for the readers to have a look at that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think these things are really useful tools. Yeah. And, you know, they sound complicated, but actually when you do it, a lot of people have taken the time. You know, there's a lot of resources from Science of Sport that are absolutely free. My blog's absolutely free. You know, there's people out there who are putting stuff out there for free for people in this situation. So don't feel intimidated by it. You know, if you look in the right places, you can actually get tools that are really simple, where 90% of the calculations behind the spreadsheet are done for you, and you just put in your numbers and it will tell you what you need to know. So they're very helpful in that respect.
Yeah, I can definitely vouch for that. I am not a spreadsheet techie, so yeah, it's been very simple for us to implement, and I would recommend that anyone grabs it off the page here and just starts utilizing it. Now, am I right, Rob, in thinking that a few of the rugby teams out there have started biobanding their squad selections, obviously because of an impact sport, and we know that if you've got 3 or 4 years worth of variance on a chronological age in relation to a physiological maturation, that, you know, you could be getting hit by a fully grown adult when you're still an early or mid-pubescent. So is that right, they're starting to adapt some of their sessions based on biobanding?
Yeah, there's some different approaches. So, you know, the one that's often lauded is New Zealand's system, which have a weight category model, which works really well if you have quite a big population. In Scotland, we don't have the same population of number of rugby players. So, you know, people have said, oh, we should bring in the weight category model they use in New Zealand. And it's like, well, that's fantastic, but that leaves you with 5 players for your school, 15. You know, so, you know, it needs to be context specific. But there are some premiership rugby clubs now that I know, I believe Bath have looked into, you know, biobanding in terms of getting a better understanding of their squad. I'm certainly at my end trying to not necessarily influence that, but, you know, we did a number of studies on relative age effect both across Scottish Rugby Union and within a specific age category. And the next step that I want to try and produce is some norms around that. And basically just just having the information to make better informed decisions. So being able to say, okay, this athlete that's on the table that we're looking at for, you know, X level of involvement within the academy, actually, how does he compare to his peers? Is he really advanced? Is he, you know, a late maturer? Do we want to hang on to him for another 12 months and see how he develops? So I think there's a number of systems out there. One is the weight category thing. Another element is biobanding and looking at, you know, within that as well. I know in football they've got, you know, the late birthday project where they're looking at tournaments specifically where it's, you know, kids in the back end of that selection year we spoke about, but also tournaments where kids are playing up and down as well as with their peers. So chronologically, but also maybe playing down a year if they're a smaller player who hasn't matured, playing up a year if they're an early maturer. So, you know, we're becoming a lot more fluid with how we consider athletic development to progress in terms of just playing under 14s with all the guys you went to school because you were born in the same year.
Yeah.
And simply, you know, we now know that what day you arrived on the planet doesn't necessarily dictate how you develop physically.
Yeah. And I think that's been quite a paradigm shift for a lot of coaches, that, you know, just not grouping basically on chronological age, which for listeners, that is just your age, your 15 or 16, your chronological age doesn't necessarily represent your true age. And I think that that is probably a big shift that's happened in some sports. And I think, and a lot of sports still have yet to do that. And I think the complexities of getting athletes working outside their social peer groups, age categories, is probably the big challenge there. But absolutely, it's great to see. And certainly, it's something that we do on our programs is we put athletes, the programs obviously, programs relative to their biological developmental age. But also, we try and group them with early, mid, and late maturers as well. So it just makes the training a bit more effective. And actually, you know, since we changed it, it was a bit of a shock to start off with, but they actually really enjoy it. I think the athletes are thankful for it in the long term.
Yeah, I think, if you think about how it's come to be, the only reason we, you know, put athletes in buckets according to age is because it was convenient for us to do.
Yeah.
You know, how do you separate, you know, these players from these players? Well, what differentiates them? It's age. You know, so the system that we have is probably, it's been around for decades, right? But it's been around before we realized there were these issues. So it's not that it was created because it's the best system. It's created because it was a convenient way to separate players and to organize matches. However, if today we were to sit down and invent how we separated athletes, we probably wouldn't do that, knowing what we know in the research. So actually, you know, it's best practice versus the way it's always been, if you like.
Yeah, it's like many things in life, it's inherited.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the way we've always done it.
Yeah. So I just want to move on to, basically, Rob, I want to give you the golden ticket and say you have got, take away all the barriers and the complexities. You've got a golden ticket and says an athlete or a group of athletes came to you with a certain background. Basically, what is the dream athlete development pathway for a young athlete coming? Being a bit of a youth athlete development specialist, I'm sure there's parents and coaches out there are wondering, what are the best sports to get my kids involved with, even knowing they don't know necessarily what sport they're going to be in yet. But I want to make sure that they have all these athletic boxes ticked. You know, what should I be doing with them? What's the dream if you want to develop your uber athlete? What would it look like? Or what would he or she look like?
I think it's funny, having spoken to athletes who've performed at a high level. So I've had this conversation with Sean Lamont, for example, you know, one of the most capped players in Scottish rugby, about his you know, athletic background, etc. And I've kind of seen common trends, and having coached athletes, you see common trends. And I think, you know, if you were to expose a child to gymnastics, to athletics, to swimming, and to some sort of either martial art or invasion game, so, you know, whether it's rugby, netball, basketball, football, etc., you know, essentially an invasion game, you've covered off a whole load of skills from basic level, you know, body awareness in your gymnastics, balance, flexibility, to, you know, decision making, spatial awareness, scanning in your invasion games. To just, you know, swimming is a fantastic one for mental psychology, you know, being able to get up early to go and, you know, to train that aerobic level of fitness and to dedicate time to that skill. So I think, you know, if you have a mixture of those things, you'd really be developing a well-rounded athlete, you know, who can produce a whole lot of movements effectively, who has a good mixture of strength, balance, mobility, flexibility, you know, explosive power, etc. So for me, when I coach an athlete, within 5 minutes, I can tell if they've done gymnastics or athletics. You know, I just came back from a training camp in Spain, where I was with Scotland under the 17s, and two of the biggest guys on the squad you know, typically, I don't know who what the tallest athlete you coached is, John, but this guy that I was coaching was 6'5".
That's pretty big.
And now, typically, when you get a 6'5" athlete, you think he's gonna move like a bag of coat hangers. He's gonna be pretty poor. And we were doing some hurdle drills, and I was like, this guy's actually pretty handy. And I said to him, I said, what sports do you play? And the guy who's 6'5" said, oh, I used to play basketball. So, you know, his whole sport's jumping, landing, twisting, turning. Another lad who was 6'3", you know, same thing. Well, I used to do athletics. So it's, you know, these guys are in a sport that's completely away from the one they used to do, but they're still benefiting from that, the movement patterns they learned in those sports.
Yeah.
And I've had that, like, in sports that are so far removed. So I remember I've trained two brothers who were swimmers. And I was like, you do not move like a swimmer. What sport did you used to do? I used to be a gymnast. You know, so it's really, yeah, it's a sport that transfers to so many other things. But I think if you have that combination of athletics, gymnastics, swimming, you know, and a martial art and invasion sport, you've really got your bases covered.
Yeah, absolutely. And all we've got to do is get the environment right for them and put them in a sport that can develop them, and then we're good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're pretty much set up there. It's just like pick which one you want and go.
Absolutely. And I think from my experience that the ones with, I mean, the gymnastics background has to be the number one for me, and maybe the martial art. The athletics one, possibly coming in a little bit later once. You know, for young athletes, once gymnastics gets to 11, 12, 13, it becomes pretty serious. So we find out they tend to drop out. And if they can convert them into sprinting, it's really, really wonderful to see what they can do. But you're absolutely right. It's almost got to a point where I'd take it a little bit further and say that if the athletes haven't done that, it's very, very challenging to develop them into performance-based athletes now, because the psychology, you know, that those sports develop, the hard work, swimming as well, I'd include clearly, and I totally agree with you. If they haven't done those things, they just don't know how to train, and it's a very long process taking athletes that haven't got that background. And I think because of all the things we were talking about earlier, the kids aren't playing as a high level of risk that they used to. They're not jumping out of the tree houses. They're not doing the knock-and-run games that used to develop a lot of speed in the same way as perhaps we might have done. And it's almost now, if they haven't done those sports, they're so held back. You know, I'd really suggest, you know, from my perspective, I totally agree with what Rob said there, guys. You know, get your young people into those sports, because they're absolutely fantastic, and they can still be doing the main sport alongside.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we've got a young athlete that we're just starting to work with this year, who's a very high level sprinter. Now, as a winger in rugby, that's an asset.
Oh yeah.
So we don't necessarily want him to stop going down the athletics track and running and sprinting.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's going to change him as a player. So there's some big, you know, kind of feed-forward loops, if you like. I mean, you only need to look at Olympic lifting in the UK to see the benefits of gymnastics. I mean, Zoe Smith was a gymnast before she went to Olympic lifting. I think Sarah Davies was similar, I believe. You know, there's a big, very obvious transfer for a lot of these things.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, really good advice, guys. Listen to that one. That's fantastic. So, Rob, moving on just a little bit. Obviously, there's a lot of coaches out there still a bit dubious about getting their athletes into strength training. I just had a conversation with a parent this morning about this. What advice would you give to any athlete any parent or a coach who's perhaps a little bit dubious and just wanting to understand what the real benefits of it are, and you know, what sort of advice would you give them about where to go and who to speak to?
I think learning is a big one. So, you know, we live in an age where we have access to the most information that's ever existed. So there's no real excuse for not going out and having a look out there. So whether you're reading books, you know, listening to podcasts, there's a number of good podcasts out there, going to workshops, conferences. So, you know, in terms of some key names that are out there, I'd say Craig Harrison, Dr. Craig Harrison, AUT Millennium in New Zealand, is a real good source of all things athletic development. He runs the Athletic Development Podcast. Or the Athletic Development Show, rather. So he's a really good resource. You know, some key kind of guys in the literature. Jan Lemoor has some really good infographics, which are basically summaries of research. So rather than going away and reading the whole paper, you know, if you're not scientifically minded, you've essentially got a little poster infographic of the key points. And he's got some really good ones on youth strength and conditioning. So, you know, being able to access some of the scientific research in a way that's applicable for you rather than for someone necessarily who's studying sports science. So he's a useful asset as well. And then, you know, I'd say there's a whole load of resources out there, you know, that are involved in this arena. So whether it's, you know, more along the podcast route. There's plenty of guys who are producing good research out there. But then key leaders, you know, if you look at people who are in the industry, so the likes of Des Ryan, he's been interviewed numerous times for podcasts in terms of those things. Jonathan for a podcast as well. James Baker from Pro Performance, who's now in Qatar. He's, you know, a real big leader in this area. And then from the research perspective, you know, John Lloyd, Rodri Oliver, Rodri Lloyd and John Oliver are the two big names as well, Sean Cumming as well. So there's plenty of resources and go-to names out there to get this information from.
And yourself as well, I'll add into that, Rob. for the listeners, you know, don't be afraid to get out on the Athlete Evolution and listen to Rob's resources on there. And look, there's a lot of free stuff available.
Yeah.
It's really fantastic.
I'd really like to emphasize that. That is why Athlete Evolution now exists, is to provide that information for the people at the bottom of the performance pyramid. It's not for people at the top, you know. People at the low end of performance in terms of mass participation, generally volunteer, mum and dad coaches who maybe don't get the resources or any kind of, you know, financial input. And I'm really about trying to provide that information at that bottom end. So, for example, you know, just discussing what we've been talking about with gymnastics and flow movements, etc. I'm actually developing some workshops up here in Edinburgh where I've reached out. We've got Shannon Archer, who's a Commonwealth gymnast, to come and do some low-level gymnastics stuff to teach youth sport coaches how to implement it with their kids. We've got Matt Whale, who's an animal flow specialist, to come and look at teaching us some of those primal movements that we can implement in our walk. So there's people out there who are doing this kind of thing, and it's applicable for you and how you can put it into your day-to-day coaching. So, yeah, keep an open mind and keep looking, and you'll come across the people that you need to see.
Yeah. Absolutely. Rob, I think we're probably going to wrap it up there. That's been absolutely incredible, and I really appreciate your time and expertise. I'm sure the listeners will really value everything you said there, and I'm sure – is it all right for the listeners to get in contact with you if they've got any specific questions? How would they go about doing that?
There's a number of ways. So you can go straight to my website, which is www.athleticevolution.co.uk. You can find the business as well on Twitter and Instagram, which is the little at sign – Athletic Evo UK, and then on Facebook, where we put regularly putting out posts and information and articles. So if you just search Athletic Evolution on Facebook, then you'll find us there. And as I mentioned, we've got those upcoming workshops. If you're based in Edinburgh or either right around Scotland or the north of England, you're welcome to come. So we'll be having two on those, the animal flow and gymnastics as a minimum.
Brilliant. Well, Rob, if you stay on the line, we'll just I'll come back to you in a second and we'll have a bit of a chat and a sign off. But just formally now, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate that. Guys, check out Rob's stuff. He's absolutely brilliant, and we were really lucky to have him over at the conference this year. Hopefully in the not-too-distant future we'll get you back over, Rob, to do something fun here.
Yeah, well, I had a great time, so I'm keen to come back.
Yeah, great. All right, Rob. Guys, thanks for listening. Also, if you could add, we've got a JSF coach education page on our Facebook page, so please subscribe to that. We put a lot of Rob's stuff on there as well, amongst a lot of other great information out there for coaches and parents to have a look at. And keep in contact and keep updated. We've got a nutrition podcast coming out tomorrow, so check that out. The podcast will be developing massively over the next few months, so keep an eye out for some really great lineups.